Folks, since I am being recorded, I should get, I just wanted to tell you that I've returned all the DCFs that I received with my perfect DCF in the subject line. I won't emphasize that. So if you sent in your DCF with my perfect DCF in the subject line, I've returned it. If you sent your DCF with some other subject line, I wouldn't even know where to find it now, to be quite honest, because I'm getting, you know, I think there have been about, I'm multiplying the number of emails I'm getting per day to how many days ago it was, sort of like 25 days ago. So that would be probably 7,000 emails away. So I can't even find it. So if you haven't got your feedback yet, my suggestion is you send your DCF again. I promise I will look at it and send it back right away. But I'm pretty much done with the DCF. I'm going to send you an email today, which will give you what I look for in a DCF, which is, you know, what are the things you check for. You can actually devise your own DCF diagnostic measure. So take a look at that email, because it'll give you some suggestions on the things that you might want to watch out for when you look at any DCF. Because let's face it, even though you might be doing a DCF, you'll be looking at other people's DCFs a lot of the time in the future, whether you're a portfolio manager, an investor, even a CFO. So I think learning how to diagnose DCFs is a good skill to have. And hopefully this email will give you some guidance. I was just checking the quizzes. Most of you look like you're already done, because when I last checked about 15, 20 minutes ago, I think you're about 175 people had completed. There were like 50 still working on it. But I'm glad you got it behind you, and that's your final quiz, obviously. And I will follow up on the final exam and what's going to be on there. But we're in the end game phase of this class now. So any questions before I get started today?
You had mentioned that you were going to send out the grading curve for the last quiz.
I thought I did. Did I not send it? I might have said three classes. Sometimes I send it to one. So I thought I sent the second quiz distribution. No?
I don't believe I got it, but it could be I just missed
okay.
it.
No, maybe I sent so many emails. Sometimes I might get lost, or I might have just not sent it. So I'll send it. You know what? I'll wait for the third quiz course so you can see the second and the third quiz put together, so you can see what the distribution looks like. Don't read too much into the distribution, because you still have a big chunk of the class left over. You've got 30% on the final exam, and I think you've got 40% on the final projects. You've got 70% of the class still left there, but I will send it out. Any other questions before we start? Okay. So today we start on packet three. So if you don't have the packet, don't worry, you can track along. And I'm going to spend the first 25 minutes, maybe 30 minutes of this class, taking you through a very quick review of option pricing. You know, option pricing is one of the more intimidating aspects in finance. You know, when people go through finance classes, the option pricing class always stops them cold, because it's a class where you see things like exponential, log normals, strange things going on. So I'm going to give you a very, very quick intuitive explanation of what option pricing tries to do, whether it's a Black-Scholes or the binomial. And then I'm going to use option pricing tools and valuation, because I'm really not interested in valuing listed options or convertible bonds. That's very different class. I'm talking about using option pricing and valuation in what's called real options. So I'm going to give you the basis for why so many people are excited about real options. You see, who's excited about real options? I know many equity research teams on Wall Street now have a real options expert online, because they use real options arguments for some companies. Every consulting firm, McKinsey, BCG, Bain, all have a real options team built on finding real option applications in practice. And just to give you how much real options have taken off, I remember the late 1990s looking for a book on real options, and I think there were two or three available. Today, you get on Amazon, type in the word real options, you'll see hundreds of books. And in finance, I'm always terrified when something becomes this popular, because we have the habit of finance of taking the obvious, you know, claiming the absurd, and then charging incredible amounts of money for people to use that practice. So let's go to the basis of the real options argument. So let's go back to capital budgeting and corporate finance. In your corporate finance class, you remember how you were taught to value a project, or even this valuation class, when talking about valuing a company, you use the discounted cash flow approach, right? Take expected cash flows, we discount them at a risk-adjusted discount rate, and we come up with a present value. And the rule is very simple. If the net present value of a project is negative, don't take the project. If the net present value is positive, take the project, right? Very simple, clear-cut rule. I'm going to muddy the waters somewhat. When you do that, all you've told me is today this project doesn't make sense, right? That's all that net present value tells you. But let's suppose I gave you the rights to this project for the next 10 years. You say, why would I want rights to a terrible project? But remember, things can change. Technology can change. Markets can change. This project could become a valuable project. That's called the option to delay. In other words, you can have a bad project, but the rights to that bad project could be valuable. So I'm going to start with an option to delay. In some cases, you might take the project with a negative net present value. See, but I'm violating finance rules. But here's your rationale. By taking that negative net present value project, it gives you the right to do very big positive net present value projects in the future. See, what are you talking about? I mean, imagine a company investing in China. Let's suppose you look at your initial investment and you say the net present value is negative. But I'm going to take it anyway. Why? Because if I invest in this project in China and it turns out to do better than expected, it gives me a chance to expand into this really big market. Now you see why this rationale can be used for taking bad investments in not only countries, which are big markets, but also businesses that are big. The cloud, artificial intelligence, cannabis, the option to expand. So I'm going to talk about the option to expand. And sometimes we underestimate the option of being able to walk away from our mistakes. That's the option to abandon. So one of the things we're going to talk about in this session and the next one are these options, what the value of these options and how they spill over into valuation. Put simply, here's what real options allow you to do. They allow you to come up with a discounted cash flow valuation for an asset and then pay a premium on it. That sounds absurd. You say, why would I pay a premium? The premium is for the option. I know it sounds really abstract, but to kind of illustrate where the value of real options comes from, I'm going to show you a decision tree. You've probably seen these in operations research or statistics classes. Let's suppose you have a decision tree. There's a 50% chance of success, in which case you make 100 million, and a 50% chance of failure, in which case you lose 120 million. Right? That's your decision tree. What's the expected value of this tree? It's very simple. You don't need a calculator. What is it, Perry?
Minus 10.
Minus 10, right? So don't take the project. Now I'm going to play a little game. Hang in there with me because he's saying, where is he going with this? Let's suppose I showed you a different decision. This decision tree, the first branch, you get a 75% chance of success, in which case you make plus 20 million, and a 25% chance of failure, in which case you lose 20 million. If you lose 20 million, you stop. File that away. If you make plus 20 million, you have a follow-up investment. And there's a two-thirds chance of succeeding in that follow-up investment, in which case you make 80 million, and a one-third chance, in which case you could lose 100 million. You say, so what? Take the sum of your positives, plus 20 plus 80 is 100, and the expected probability across both branches, three-quarters times two-thirds is a half. There's a 50% chance of a plus 100, and a 50% chance of minus 120. Very similar to the previous case. But here's the magic. If I take the expected value of this particular decision tree, the negative value goes away. Something about breaking this decision tree up into two branches seems to create value for me. So what is it in the second tree that you're getting that you did not get in the first tree that's shifting the present value or the value of this, or the expected value? What are you getting in the second tree? Anybody want
the
to try?
Option, the option?
I'll tell you what the option is here.
Stop loss, correct.
The option is basically, if you get a bad outcome in the first branch, you stop. Right? That's really what, there are two things going on. One is, there's learning, which is that first tree gives you some information about this project. And adaptive behavior. Adaptive behavior in what form? If you get a bad outcome in that first tree, you stop. Those are the building blocks for real options. Learning and adaptive behavior. said, what are you talking about? Let me give you a very simple illustration of how this is going to play out. Let's suppose I decide to value an oil company today. So here's what I do. I take the number of barrels of oil that I expect the oil company to produce next year, 2 years out. So if you look at my Aramco valuation, it's basically production of oil times an expected oil price, and I get expected cash flows, and I discount them all back today and call that the value of the oil company. What is it that I'm doing in a discounted cash flow valuation that misses? What am I missing in that discounted cash flow valuation when I do that? When I take expected barrels of oil times oil price every year and do the discounting, what am I missing?
You can stop the production.
I'm sorry, Siki, what did you say?
You're missing the best scenarios and the worst scenarios of the case.
Well, I think that can be said about any DCF, right? It's more than that. What do I get to observe as an oil company before I decide how much to produce?
Yeah, they can change their production based on the price.
Exactly, right? So if oil prices are $100 a barrel, I'm going to produce a million barrels of oil. But if oil prices drop to $15 a barrel, I might not make my production zero, but I would definitely not produce it. So you see what I'm missing in natural resource companies? By using an expected price, even if it's a reasonable price, an expected production, even if it's a reasonable production, I'm missing the optionality. I'm missing the fact that oil companies can learn from looking at the oil price and adapt their production to reflect the oil price. That, in a nutshell, is so. If somebody wants you to explain real options, don't pull out the bazooka launchers and the big ammunition. Just use that type of example because it brings home what you're missing in a traditional DCF: the fact that you can observe what's happening and change your behavior based on that. That is at the heart of real options. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a skeptic's view of real options. And I'll tell you why I use the skeptic's view. Remember early in this class, we talked about weapons of mass distraction. We talked about China. We talked about strategic. We talked about synergy. Real options have become a weapon of mass distraction. Because here's how I see them used. You value a company and the person would say, I'm going to pay 50% more. And you say, why are you paying 50% more? You know what their answer is? Real options. It's become a more sophisticated way of saying, I'm going to pay a premium. Don't stop me because I'm using a really good buzzword. I don't like that. So I'm going to give you three questions that I think need to be asked and answered anytime somebody talks about real options. First is, we need to talk about when there's an option in this decision. When should we even be talking about option pricing? The paper that I have on this topic that I wrote about 20 years ago, I'll give you the title of the paper. Opportunities are not options. And the reason I said that is I saw people talking about how growth companies had options because they had lots of potential growth. They were mistaking opportunities for options. So we're going to talk about what it is about options that makes them unique investments. And when should I think about options in a decision process? Second question, this is a particularly critical question, real options, is when does that real option that I've identified have significant economic value? I'm going to argue that 90% of options you see out there are worthless, and I'm going to talk about why. So I'm going to talk about when does an option have significant economic value? So when is there an option? When does an option have significant economic value? And the third question I'm going to ask is, when can I use an option pricing model to value that option? Because that's what I'm going to try to do. So let's start with the first one. Let's think about what makes options unique. Options are derivative assets. They're niches. They derive their value from an underlying asset. So the first thing you need for an option is you need to identify the underlying asset. Second, options have contingency. Their cash flows are driven by the contingency. You see, what are you talking about? If you buy a call option, here's the contingency. The stock price has to be greater than the strike price for you to exercise the option. There's a contingent payoff. And finally, options have a finite life. So there's got to be an underlying asset. There's got to be a contingency for the cash flow. And there's got to be a finite life. In fact, the best way to identify an option is to go back to basics. One of the things that sets options apart is the payoff diagram for an option has a very unique shape. This is the payoff diagram for a call option. What makes it unique? There's a contingency. Stock price has to be greater than the strike price. There's a kink at the strike price. If the stock price exceeds the strike price, you make dollar for dollar, you make profits. But if the stock price is less than the strike price, Your losses are limited to whatever you paid for the option. That is key. The option, in an option payoff diagram, your losses are limited, your profits are potentially unlimited. That's for a call option. With a put option, if the stock price is less than the strike price, you make money. But if the stock price is greater than the strike price, you lose whatever you paid for the put option. Hold on to that thought that options have limited losses, because it's going to drive how we think about what drives the value of an option. So one of the things I'm going to do anytime I talk about a real option is I'm going to draw the payoff diagram. So when I talk about patents or undeveloped oil reserves as options, I'm going to draw the payoff diagram. I'm going to identify the underlying asset. I'm going to give you the contingency that makes it an option. And then I have to back up why your losses will be limited for it to be actually an option. That's the first step, is identifying an option. Draw the payoff diagram. If that payoff diagram looks anything like the call or the put, you got an option to deal with. That's my first stop. Any questions on finding out when there's an option? The payoff diagram is the best indicator. Now let's get to the second question. When does that option have significant economic value? I'm going to tell you a story, and this is a true story. You might not believe it, but it is a true story. It's about 15 years ago, end of a valuation class, and it wasn't unsettled like this one online. It was a real physical class. You know, I think the 14th week of the class, end of the semester, second year MBA comes into my office and says, I'm done, I'm graduating, and I rent this apartment. He rented an apartment in New York City, and my landlord has given me the option to buy the apartment anytime over the next year. And I said, that's nice. He said, I want to use a Black-Scholes model to value this option. I said, aren't you getting a little carried away? He said, no, I'm spending a lot of money on my MBA. I want to try it out. I said, okay. I said, what price did your landlord say you could buy this apartment at anytime over the next year? He thought about it for a moment. He said, you know what? He never mentioned the price. So then I asked him a follow-up question. I said, how much do you think the option to buy your apartment at whatever the prevailing market price is worth? What do you think the answer to that question is? If I gave you the right to buy the apartment you're renting right now at whatever the prevailing market price is anytime over the next year, what's that option worth? Absolutely nothing, exactly. Because anybody can buy that apartment at the prevailing market price. So I'm going to introduce a word that to me is key in separating fact from fiction and options. The word is exclusivity. For an option to have value, you and only you should be able to exercise the option. You need to have exclusivity. We're going to use that test when we talk about options in practice, real options in practice, because you're going to see many people when they talk about, hey, I can expand into China. All you need to do is ask them a question. What makes you special? Do you think you're the only one who can expand in China? Show me you have an exclusive license from the government to expand in China. Then we can talk options. But exclusivity becomes that word that determines when an option is significant economic value. So is there an option? Second stop, when does an option have significant economic value? If you can pass those two tests, then we know what drives the value of an option. We've known for almost 50 years, since 1971, when Fisher Black and Myron Scholes came up with the option. There are six and only six variables that determine the value of an option. Three relate to the underlying asset. As the value of an underlying asset goes up and down, the value of options will go up and down as well, depending on what type of option you have. With a call option, you get the right to buy the asset at a fixed price, right? So the value of the underlying asset goes up, call options will become more valuable, put options will become less valuable. That's the first variable. As the value of the underlying asset goes up and down, call options and put options will be affected. The second stop is the variance in that underlying asset. And here's where options separate from everything else we've talked about in this class. Up till this moment in this class, when we've talked about risk, it's always been a bad thing. In discounted cash flow valuation, risk pushes up your discount rate, it pushes down your value. In pricing, risk pushes down your multiple, pushes down your pricing. But when it gets to options, risk becomes your ally. As the variance in the value of the underlying asset increases, the value of both calls and puts becomes higher. We talked a little bit about this earlier in the class, but let's nail this down. What is it about options that makes risk your ally rather than your enemy? Darshan?
The payout curve, the losses are limited.
The downside is limited, right? So think about it. When you think about risk, you're never worried about upside risk. It's downside risk that worries you. With an option, I'm constraining your downside. That is the key change when it comes to real options. Risk is now going to become your ally because the higher the risk, the greater the value of the option. Third, any expected dividends on the underlying asset will affect your value as a call or a put option. See why? Think about owning a call option on a stock. Let's assume that 2 weeks from now, the stock is going to pay a big dividend. You know exactly how much the dividend it is, so you know the dividend is coming. Why should you, as a call option holder, be worried about the dividend? What happens on the X dividend day to your stock price? For those of you in our corporate finance class, this is a little unfair because we just talked about this today. Darshan, what happens to the X dividend day to the stock?
The price goes down by the dividend amount.
Price goes down by roughly the amount of the dividend. Now, as a call option holder, you see why this is bad. You get the right to buy at a fixed price. You know a dividend is coming. You've got to reduce how much you pay for the call to reflect that expected price drop. If you're a put option holder, the exact opposite will work. So here's what you have. As the value of the underlying asset increases, call options become more valuable, put options become less valuable. As variance increases, both calls and puts become more valuable. As the expected dividends that will be paid out in the stock goes up, call options become less valuable, put options become more valuable. Those are the three variables relating to the underlying asset. There are two variables relating to the option itself. One is, remember the call option gives you the right to buy at a fixed price. That's called the strike price. The lower that strike price, the more valuable the call is going to be. And here's why. If I gave you the right to buy your apartment at $50,000, that's worth more than giving you the right to buy that same apartment at $150,000. The lower the strike price, the higher the value of the call. But with the put option, you get the right to sell at that fixed price. So the lower the strike price, the less valuable put options become. The life of the option, the longer the time I let you play this game, the more valuable all options become. So like variance, the life of the option will make both call and put options more valuable. The longer the life, the more valuable the option. The only macro variable that enters into the value of options is what interest rates are, and here's why it shows up. With a call option, you get the right to buy something at a fixed price sometime in the future, right? So let's say I give you the right to buy your apartment at $1 million 2 years from now. Here's why interest rates matter. Interest rates are 50%. The present value of $1 million 2 years from now is much less than if interest rates are 5%. So as interest rates go up, here's what should happen. The values of call option should increase because you don't have to pay that price until 2 years from now. The present value effect kicks in. And the value of put options decreases because getting $1 million 2 years from now is worth less when interest rates are 50% rather than 5%. So let's review. Value of the underlying asset, variance in the value, and expected dividend from the underlying asset. Strike price and life of the option on the option itself and level of interest rate. That's it. Those are the six variables. Now the question is, how do you get them all into an option pricing model? Let me give you a little bit of history. Prior to 1971, people valued options like every other asset. They took expected cash flows, they discounted them back, they did a risk-adjusted discount rate, they came up with a value. And in 1971, Fisher, Black, and Martin Scholes came up with a revolutionary idea. They said options are derivative assets. They derive the value from an underlying asset. So we can create something that looks exactly like the options. What do you mean looks like the option? Has the same cash flows as the option in every conceivable scenario. By combining the underlying asset and a risk-free asset. Say, what are you talking about? You give me a call option on the stock. I can create something that looks exactly like the call option by combining borrowing money and buying shares in the stock. You say, how much should I borrow? How many shares of stock should I buy? That's what the option pricing model will answer for you. That's called a replicating portfolio. The replicating portfolio has exactly the same cash flows as the option. But to create that replicating portfolio, I need to be able to trade the underlying asset. I need to be able to borrow and lend money at the risk-free rate. And I need to be able to buy and sell the option. So basically the option has to be traded, the underlying asset has to be traded, and you can borrow and lend money at the risk-free asset. I'll be quite honest, the borrower and lend money at the risk-free asset is the least troublesome of those three assumptions. The first two can get you into trouble, especially with real options. But the first step in every option pricing model is a replicating portfolio. The second step in getting the model is what's called arbitrage. Remember I said the replicating portfolio has the same cash flows as the option. Since they have the same cash flows, they should trade at the same price, right? But if they, because if they don't, you have arbitrage. You'd buy the cheaper one, you'd sell the more expensive one, you'd lock in the profit, and since the cash flows even out, you'll have no risk. So the two building blocks for all of option pricing is replication and arbitrage. If you understand that, you're well on your way to understanding option pricing. Because when you want to think about option pricing, you want to think about that replicating portfolio. How do I create something that looks exactly like my option? It's not difficult. Think about a call option. The way you create something that looks like a call option is by borrowing money and buying what's called delta shares of stock. You know, 0.8 shares of stock, 0.6. As I said, that's what the option pricing model is going to tell you, is how much you need to borrow and how many. But borrowing and buying shares, the underlying asset, can create something that looks like the call. It's called a synthetic call because you're making it, you're creating it yourself. To replicate a put, here's what you need to do. You need to sell short on the underlying asset. And again, I have to tell you how many shares. And take the cash you get from that selling short and lend it at the risk-free rate, which would be investing in T-bonds or T-bills or whatever you want to invest. The number of shares you need to buy to replicate an option is called the option delta. And the principles of arbitrage kick in here, which is since they have exactly the same cash flows, that replicating position should cost you the same as the option. When I was taught option pricing, I was started in the level of abstraction. You never got to see what a replicating portfolio looked like until about the 1980s when somebody came up with this. I mean, I think Mark Rubenstein at UC Berkeley came up with this extremely clever way of showing what a replicating portfolio looked like using what's called a binomial model. Binomial model came after the Black-Scholes, but I'm going to use the binomial model first because you can see replication. What's a binomial model? In a binomial model, the stock can jump to only one of two points. So let's suppose you have a stock trading at 50. In the next time period, it can either go to 70 or it can drop to 35. That's what makes it binomial. In a minute, I'm going to ask you why we use a binomial, why not a trinomial or a quadrinomial model? Two steps. If it goes to 70, it can go up to 100 or 50. If it drops to 35, it can go to 50 or 25. So if you think as this is t equal to 1 and this is t equal to 2, at the end of the second time period, this stock can be worth 25, 50, or 100. Right now, you're at 50. Let's assume that you're looking to buy a call option with a strike price of 40. You know what that means, right? At the end of time period 2, you will get to buy the shares at $40 and ask you how much did you pay for that call option? I mean, the strike price is 40. What I'm going to do is create a replicating portfolio at each step. But to do it, I'm going to start at T equal to 2. Binomial option pricing model, you always start at the end and you work backwards because at the end, you know exactly what the cash flows will be. If the stock goes to 100 and you have the right to buy at 40, think of what to do. You go buy the shares at 40, you sell it at 100, you make 60. So the cash flow on your call is going to be worth 60. If the stock goes to 50, you buy at 40, you turn around and sell at 50, you make 10. If the stock goes to 25, why don't you buy at 40 and sell at 25? Because you're not stupid. You have the right to buy at 40. You don't have an obligation. So in an option, what you do, the stock price goes to 25, is you drop the option in the trash can and say, I wish I hadn't done that. So the value of my call, or the cash flow on my call, is going to be 60, 10, or 0 at T equal to 2, which is the time it expires. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back one time period. I'm going to take a price. Let's say it's 70 and say, what would I need to do if the stock price is 70? In terms of combining the underlying stock and borrowing so that my cash flows are exactly the same cash flows as a call. So let's play a game in abstraction. Let's assume I borrow B dollars. You see how much is B hanging there for a moment. And I buy delta shares of stock or D shares of stock. If I borrow, you know, B dollars and buy delta shares of stock, here's what my cash flows will look like if the stock goes to 100. I'll have 100 times delta, that's the number of shares times the stock price. I'll have to repay the borrowing with interest. And let's say the interest rate is 11%. So 100 times delta minus 1.11 times B will be the value of my replicating portfolio if the stock goes to 100. What do I want it to do? I want it to have the same cash flows as the call. So if the stock goes to 100, I want my replicating portfolio to have a cash flow of 60. If the stock goes to 50, I want my replicating portfolio to have cash flows of 10. So I set up, I have two equations. I know it's been a long time, but remember, was it high school probably, or even middle school? You did simultaneous equations. You have two equations and two unknowns. You work long enough and hard enough. At the end of the last part, there should be no unknowns. So what you're trying to do is decide how much to borrow and how many shares of stock, and you're using the cash flows and the call option as a way of backing in. So if I solve that equation, I get D equal to 1 and B equal to 30%. What does that even mean? If I go out and borrow $36.04 and buy one share of stock at 70, that position will have exactly the same cash flows as the call. But that position, it will cost me, if I think about myself as the person bringing in the equity, will cost me $33.96. Buying one share costs 70, but $36.04 is borrowed. So the replicating portfolio has a will cost me $33.96. But with the arbitrage, the call has to be worth $33.96 as well. Sammy, can you? I don't know where I lost you. So if you want to unmute yourself and ask me the question, you're welcome to. Or you know, you can hold off till later.
So I just got confused. You start from the end, from the right to the left, or from the left?
Yeah, you start from the right to the left because you know exactly what the call is going to be worth only at expiration. So that's why I always start at T equal to 2 and work backwards.
Okay, understood. Thanks.
So I've got my value for the call if the stock goes to 70. I repeat the same thing, the stock goes to 35. I'm not sure. And here, if I solve the simultaneous equation, here's what I get. I need to borrow $9.01 and buy 0.4 shares of stock. Don't even ask me how you buy 0.4, act like you can. That position cost me $4.99. If the stock goes to 35, my replicating portfolio cost me $4.99. Because of arbitrage, the call's got to be worth $4.99. You see what I've done now? I now have the value of the call at T equal to 1. $33.96 if the stock goes to 70, $4.99 if the stock goes to 35. I then move back to T equal to 0. So at T equal to 0 now, the stock's at 50. I ask exactly the same question. How much do I borrow? How much do I need to buy? And when I solve that equation, here's what I get as my final equation. I borrow $21.61 today, and I buy 0.8278 shares of stock today. I've created a replicating portfolio that'll pay for itself through its entire life and has exactly the same values and cash flows as the call option. That replicating portfolio today will cost me $19.42. That's going to be the value of a call with a strike price of 40 that expires at T equal to 2. So you can see with the binomial equation at each step, I'm trying to create that replicating portfolio. Now, the binomial model is an incredibly intuitive way to see replication work out, but it's also very limiting. Why? Because at every point in time, the stock can jump to only one or two points. Let's say you tried this for Boeing. Time can't be one day, right? At the end of one day, the stock can be anything of 100 different points. So to have any chance of having a binomial model work, I've got to make T really small. Can't be a day, can't be an hour. It can't even be a minute, maybe a second. Let's say in a second, the stock can jump to only one of 2 points. You think that's good? I'll make T equal to 1 second. Let's say you have a 3 month option. How many seconds do you have in 3 months? Don't even answer the question. It's a lot of seconds. But let's say you're a very, very patient person. You decide to draw a binomial tree with 1 second time intervals for 3 months. So you take this very sharp pencil and very large paper and you start drawing this tree, tiny, tiny branches. You finish the tree. You done? You're going to have this really dense tree, right? Here's what I want you to do. Flip the tree over. So see this, it's going sideways. Flip it on its base. What's it going to look like? It's going to look like a pine tree without a base. Now smooth out the outside edges. What does it start to look like? If I took a binomial distribution, made it really dense, flipped it over on its base, base being this the end period, and I smoothed out the outsides, you know what it's going to look like? I know I've led you on a
bell curve.
It's going to look like a bell curve. It's going to look like a normal distribution. Hey, you know what? You've just derived the Black-Scholes. If I take the binomial model and make time really small, and as I make time really small, I also make my price changes really small. It's called a continuous price distribution. The binomial distribution becomes the Black-Scholes. The Black-Scholes model is a special case of the binomial model. You say, why a special case? Because as time gets smaller, price changes might not get smaller. Prices can still jump in a second. We've seen it happen. That's called a jump process distribution. There are other versions of auction pricing models built around jump process distributions. You know why you never see them? Because the inputs you need to use those models are so difficult to get, so messy, that we continue to use the Black-Scholes, even though we know prices don't move continuously. The bottom line is when you use a Black-Scholes model to value options, you will tend to undervalue deep out of the money options. You know why? Why would assuming continuous price distributions lead you to undervalue deep out of the money options? What are deep out of the money options? The strike price is way above the stock price for a call option. Why do you think Black-Scholes lead you to undervalue?
Is it because it underestimates the volatility?
It underestimates the chance. So to get from 30 to 70 in the Black-Scholes model, you know what would have to happen? You'd have to go 30, 30 or 1, 30 or 2. That's what continuous price distributions do. But when you're getting through the 30 to 70 in the real world, what usually happens? Usually it's a biotech company and some test that they were running on a blockbuster drug came out with good results. The stock jumps from 30 to 100. The reason the Black-Scholes would underestimate the value out of the money options is underestimate the chances of big jumps. But it's built in. That's the nature of the model. And in fact, in the original Black-Scholes, the value of a call option was a function of five variables. Five variables. I'm going to list them out. And the reason I emphasize the word five, if you remember a few slides ago, I said there were six variables that drive the value of the option. So as I list out the five variables, I'd like you to tell me what the missing variable is. So here are the five variables that showed up in the original Black-Scholes. S, the value of the underlying asset. K, which is the strike price of the option. T, which is the life of the option. R, which is the riskless rate. And sigma squared. Don't ask me why sigma becomes, you know, question marks, right? Which is a variance. S, K, T, R, and sigma. What's a missing variable? What am I missing in the original Black-Scholes? You can turn back. Zhao said dividends. Zhao, dividends. The original Black-Scholes didn't have dividends in it. Why? I'll tell you the truth. Fisher, Black, and Warren shows when they were deriving the Black-Scholes model, and legend has, you know, it's, you know, this is just, you know, through the backstory, were trying to derive the model and they got stuck. The mathematics were really messy. Nobody in finance had ever seen something like that. In fact, legend has it that they got stuck on the paper, it was lying on their office desk, and a physics PhD student who happened to be wandering through the University of Chicago's office went into the office, looked at it and said, hey, we do this in physics all the time with stochastic calculus. And that's what allowed them to complete the model, which means that the Nobel Prize should have gone to Fisher, Black, Myron Scholes, and this unknown student, PhD student in physics. But the point I'm trying to make is the math was so rigorous that they wanted to keep it simple. So the original Black-Scholes was designed to value options on stocks that either never paid a dividend or stocks which were or options which were dividend protected. You're saying, what's a dividend protected option? Remember what I said about call options becoming less valuable because of the ex-dividend day, the stock price drops by roughly the amount of the dividend? If you had a dividend protected option, your strike price would also get adjusted if that happened. There are no dividend protected options in the world, but the original Black-Scholes ignore those dividends. We'll come back and talk about what if there are dividends, because in the real world, obviously, you have to deal with dividends. But in the original Black-Scholes, here's what the model looked like. The value of a call is S, which is the value of the stock today, times N of D1. You say, what the heck is N of D1? It's K E minus RT. You say, what the heck is that? E minus RT. We'll come to that as well, times N of D2. Let's take it apart. The original Black-Scholes, here's what they did. K is the strike price, right? Remember, you don't have to pay the strike price until the expiration date. That's the other hidden secret in the Black-Scholes. It was designed to value what are called European options. It's unfortunate that we attach a geographical term to it. It's nothing to do with Europe. The European option, the option can be exercised only at expiration. So the strike price doesn't have to be paid till the expiration date. You know what E minus RT is? It's a present value factor. I've told people, if you don't have an exponential key in your calculator, just take the present value of the strike price. E minus RT is just the present value of the strike price because you don't have to pay it till the expiration date. Yeah, you're saying, what about N of D1 and N of D2? I'm going to take a diversion. D1 and D2 are a function of all those variables we talked about, S, K. That's the stochastic calculus kicking through. Once I get the D1 and the D2, I turn to what's called a cumulative normal distribution. So let's say the D1 I get is minus 0.10. 0.4602 is the area of the distribution. So usually when you think about normal distributions, you have the height. In a cumulative normal distribution, you have an area. So basically, I take D1 and I look up the area under the normal distribution to the left. Very simply put, N of D1 and N of D2 are like probabilities. In fact, N of D2 has a very specific meaning. It's the risk-neutral probability that your option will be in the money. Let me repeat that again. It's, remember, S is the value of the stock today, K is the strike price. N of D2 measures in a risk-neutral way the probability that S will be greater than K. For the moment, just file that away. We'll come back and draw on that when we use real options. So N of D1 and N of D2 are probabilities. But you're saying, where's the replicating portfolio? It's in there. In the Black-Scholes model, here's what the replicating portfolio will look like. Buy N of D1 shares of stock. That's the option delta. And you borrow the present value of the strike price times N of D2. You've created the replicating portfolio. So what we did in the Black-Scholes happens, I'm sorry, in the binomial, happens in the Black-Scholes. In fact, everything in options is built around the replicating portfolio. I already told you option delta is N of D1. You know what our option gamma is? As the stock price changes, the option delta will change. The option gamma measures how much the delta will change as the stock price changes. What's your option vega? As the standard deviation changes, your replicating portfolio will change. That's what the option vega measures. The option theta measures what the value of the option will be as time changes. Option traders have invaded the Greek language and taken it over. And they use it as a weapon against you. You don't understand option theta, go away. But everything they're doing is built around that replicating portfolio. Any questions on the original Black-Scholes?
I hope we are not expected to do this stuff on the final.
What stuff?
Like calculating in
D1 and D2? I definitely think you should be able to do it. What part of that is going to be difficult? You can. There's a small log on your calculator. There's an exponential in your calculator. I don't expect you to derive the Black-Scholes, but I expect you to be able to use the Black-Scholes.
Interesting.
And also you have your, you know, I'll make your life even simpler. You can use your laptop. And I have the normal, I have the Black-Scholes built in. So if you can put an SK, RT, and sigma, my calculator will compute it for you. So the key is getting the inputs right. Anybody can use the Black-Scholes. This is mechanical. Getting the inputs right is what I'm really going to test you on. Go ahead, Ayla.
Yeah, Professor, can you explain one more time the difference between D1 and D2?
It's just a function. If you set sigma to zero, the two numbers will converge. It's just a function that you're, remember I said N of D1 and N of D2 are probabilities, but because you're uncertain about the future, there's a range on your probabilities. So think of D1 and D2 as giving you that range, and the more standard deviation, more uncertain you're about the future, the bigger that range.
And D1 is the probability of...
Not D1, N of D1 is a probability. N of D2 has a very specific meaning. It's a risk neutral probability. N of D1 has a lesser meaning, but it's also, they're both probabilities, but N of D2 is the key probability. That's a probability you're gonna, if somebody asks you, what's the probability this option will be in the money, you're gonna give them N of D2.
And that's N of D2.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Now, one final adjustment. As I said, the original Black-Scholes didn't have dividends, but many of the real options we're going to be using will have a component that's very similar to dividends. So we've wrestled with how to use the Black-Scholes to these options. And there's one way you can very quickly bring dividends into the equation. You can adapt the Black-Scholes model to allow for dividends, if you're willing to make an assumption that the dividend yield on the underlying asset remains unchanged. Here's what's going to happen. Remember the original model, so compare this model if you want to the previous version of the model so you can see what's different. The original version of the model, I took the stock price times N of D1, right? If you have an expected dividend yield on the stock, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the stock price today, but I'm going to reduce it by the expected dividends on the stock. You say, why are you doing that? Remember what we said happens with the X dividend day? The stock price drops. What I'm doing is I'm taking today's stock price and reducing it for the fact that I'm going to have a 2% dividend every year for the next 3 years. So that brings in the dividend effect into the stock prices. But here's the other effect. Remember in your replicating portfolio for a call option, you borrowed money and you bought shares of stock. In a world with no dividends, when you borrow money, you have a cost, which is an interest cost, and the dividends give you nothing. But if dividends, if the stock gives you nothing, but if stocks have dividends, here's what's going to happen. You're going to make interest payments on your debt, but you're going to be able to make some of those payments using the dividends you receive on the shares you bought. So you look inside the D1 and D2, here's the difference. Instead of taking just the risk-free rate, I'm going to take the risk-free rate minus the dividend yield. It's a carrying cost of your replicating portfolio, and it's now lower because of dividends in the stock. So what this equation does is it takes the Black-Scholes and it brings in dividends. So I'm going to make a confession up front. I'm going to use the Black-Scholes model to value real options, and a pure option, an option purist will be pissed off at me for a couple of reasons. Option purists say you cannot use Black-Scholes model to value real options because most real options get exercised early. Remember we said the original Black-Scholes was designed to value European options? Most options out there are American options. What are American options? American options can be exercised anytime up to expiration, not just on the expiration date. So their argument, you shouldn't be using Black-Scholes, you should be using a binomial model. Technically, they're right. But you know what the problem with purity is? Purists. Purists never get to apply things because they're so caught up in being pure that they want to show that the right model is the model that they will use, but they can't figure out how to use it. It is absolutely true that the Black-Scholes model will understate the value of real options which can get exercised early because I'm valuing it as a European option. But I would argue that the kind of information you will need to use a binomial model is so extensive that I'd rather use the Black-Scholes, which is a flawed model, to get a value than use the binomial and get stuck on the inputs. In fact, if you have the information to actually use a binomial model, I would argue there's a far simpler alternative you can use, which is a decision tree. Which is if you get in a binomial, because remember in a binomial model, I'd have to estimate cash flows at every step in the process. And if you're able to estimate cash flows at every step, if you can add probabilities to each step, you can come up with an expected value without ever using an option. So I know this sounds abstract, but let me give you a closing example. It's a very simple illustration of how a decision tree can be used to value something with optionality. Let's assume you're a small pharmaceutical company. You've developed a or you're thinking about developing a diabetes drug. So you right now, you're here. So the way to read decision trees is a circle is a probabilistic node. It's a node where fate delivers an outcome. You don't control it. A triangle is your choice. So right now, you're right there. You're thinking about, should I test this drug? If you test this drug, here's what can happen. There's a 70% chance of success and a 30% chance of failure. If you fail, whatever you spend, in this case, $50 million to do the test, you've got to write off. So that's a decision tree. If you fail, you stop. If you succeed with a 70% chance, then you do a follow-up test. If the follow-up test turns out that this drug is good for treating both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, that's your best case outcome, then you follow up with a second test. And if it succeeds, you develop the drug, and your best case outcome is this is a drug that treats both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and the cash flow value that you get is $887 million. So in each step, here's what I'm doing. I'm looking at the cash flows, I'm looking at the outcomes, and I'm taking an expected value. So if you go to the N nodes, you see that this drug could have values ranging anywhere from $887 million, the best case scenario, to minus $329 million in potentially the worst case scenario. I'm right here. I have to decide what to do. So here's what you do. You roll back the decision tree. That's just a technical term of taking expected values and accept. So you see these bold numbers? I'm just rolling back these outcomes to see what my expected value is. So if I succeed at both stages of the test, my expected value is 574 million. If I succeed for the first level, but in the second, it works out to be only good for type 2 diabetes, my expected value is minus 144 million. If it's good for type 1, it's 402 million. So I've got my expected values, and I take my expected value today, the value that I get for developing this drug, rolling all the way through the tree, this 50.36 million. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to do this on the final exam, but again, doing this is not difficult, it's tedious. You've got to work through step at a time, you've got to attach probabilities. The reason I like looking at this decision tree is sometimes I think people bring out the options ammunition too quickly. The problem with option technology is it's very intimidating. You go to a CFO and you show them an option pricing model. Most people, forget about CFOs, most people, when you show them option pricing models, get intimidated. Maybe that's your end game. Maybe you want to intimidate people, bring out black shows, go to town, valuing everything with a binomial option pricing model. But if you don't have to bring it out, you're going to be much more effective if you can use something that's more intuitive. And decision trees are much more intuitive. They're built on cash flows and probabilities. So I'm saying if you have the information to actually get the cash flows, you might as well use decision trees. Most of the time when I'm using the Black-Scholes model, the value real options, it's because I don't want to do the cash flows and I don't want to do the decision tree. So I'm apologizing upfront to those of you who are option purists for the fact that I will be using Black-Scholes model starting in the next class, spilling into the next one to value real options. And we're going to look at in a sense, I know today's class was a grind in terms of working through option pricing, but if you can go back and review it, I'm not going to ask you to derive Black-Scholes and binomial model, but I want you to think about the intuition that allows us to get to where Black and Scholes got, which is you can value an option by looking at that replicating portfolio and drawing an arbitrage. So before I stop for today, are there any questions? So take a look at the slides today. Don't get intimidated if you don't get every single step. Think about getting the intuition, because if you get the intuition, you're 95% of the way to nailing options, because the intuition of replicating portfolios and arbitrage is much more critical than going through the algebra of doing through this.
All right, Professor, so you said if you were a purist, you would be, or if one were a purist, they would be upset at you using Black-Scholes to price a real option.
Yeah.
Why is
that? Black-Scholes doesn't allow for early exercise. It's a European option. I'll give you an example. Okay. Yeah, when you do an undeveloped oil reserve and you value it as an option, exercise is actually developing the oil reserve. In the Black-Scholes model, you never develop it if you thought of it as a European option, because you'd wait till the very last day of the rights and you said, today I'm going to get oil up. The essence of real options, you want to develop patents, you want to develop natural resource reserves. So you need real early exercise. So their argument is Black-Scholes model doesn't work because it doesn't allow for early exercise. But that's a cop-out. I think Black-Scholes models can be adapted for early exercise. At least they can give you a floor on the value. Whereas binomial model, you're just going to get stuck trying to get the inputs you need to get the model going off the ground.
But binomial is a kind of, it gives you that optionality to exercise it quick, like early.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. The binomial, you can actually stop at a branch.
Okay.
What you get by exercising. So binomial actually gives you a chance of stopping early if the value of exercise is better.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Well, in fact, I'm glad Shashanka raised the question. Why do we continue to use Black-Scholes with listed options? Because when you look at CBOE options, they're American options. So why there is it okay to use Black-Scholes? What percentage of listed options get exercised early? Very, 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 like 1%. 99% of listed options, you always make more money by selling the option to somebody else than by exercising, right? So even if you guess right, you get almost never get early exercise. That's why you continue to see Black-Scholes models used there, because their early exercise is very rare to non-existent. With real options, it's going to be much more common. In fact, it's going to be par for the course. And that's why I think people push back. again, it's using a Black-Scholes model, which is a European option pricing model. Any final questions? Okay, so I think that's, go ahead, Siki.
Yeah, I have a question about the final exam. Is the final exam still multiple choices and cumulative?
Yeah. It is still multiple choice and it's still cumulative.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Professor,
Sammy, go ahead.
Humbly saying, since I know nothing about Black-Scholes, would just looking at Khan Academy would suffice in this case?
You just need a basic understanding. Black-Scholes basically just need to understand the notion of the replicating portfolio and the notion of arbitrage, because you understand that the rest of Black-Scholes is just derivation. So you don't need to know why is there log of S over K in D1. You just need to understand how the process plays out. That you, in fact, in Black-Scholes, all you're doing is taking the binomial model and crunching it up in time. Yeah. If you get that, the rest, I don't think you need to spend too much time in learning the derivation. You do need to know how to use the Black-Scholes, but that just means getting comfortable with those buttons on your calculator you haven't been touching for a long time, right? Natural log, exponential. So work through a couple of Black-Scholes problems and get comfortable with how it works in terms of mechanics, but don't get bogged down in deriving the Black-Scholes.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry, Professor. Samir? Sorry. Go ahead.
Yep. I had a question on this slide from last class. It is slide 163.
Tell me what you had a question about. I don't have
the slide. Yep, no problem. So if you remember, you gave us an example of Twitter where the offered price was $27, but then it opened at $45.
Yeah.
Right. And then you said it was, you know,
if like 100% would be the shares, pissed. If 100% of the shares are issued, I said the issuing company is going to be really pissed off.
Right.
Why? Because you've left.
And my question is.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yep. So my question, why will it be pissed off? Because it is going to get $45, right? Not 27.
Wait, you're the VC. Yeah. You have a million shares. I just sold you a million shares at $28. The guy who bought it made 17 extra dollars. Wouldn't he be pissed off? Because that 17 million should have come to you. You built this company, you take it public, you set it for 28 million. Some trader bought the shares at 28 million, flipped it, and got 45 million.
So the first investor, meaning when the market opens up, it opens up at 45, not 27, right?
It opens at 40. No, but remember, the shares are placed with the people who subscribe. So if you do 100% offering, basically those shares are sold to the people in the offering. So it might be clients of the investment bank, portfolio managers who get the shares at 28. You don't own the shares at 28 once those shares have been placed with those people. So you've lost the shares at 28. They then sell it at 45.
Okay.
You don't get the $45 as a VC.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
So, Professor, quickly, both the Black-Scholes and the binomial model are based on the synthetic portfolio.
Exactly, the replicating portfolio.
Replicate.
It's just a little more hidden in the Black-Scholes, right? The binomial, it's how you get there.
Yeah.
The Black-Scholes, that's why when people blindly use the Black-Scholes and ask them why the replicating portfolio, they say, "What replicating portfolio?" 95% of the people who use Black-Scholes, we ask them, where's the replicating? They have no idea. It's just punch numbers in. You're already way ahead of most of them because you can say, I can show you what the replicating portfolio looks like. It's N of D1, the option delta times number of shares of stock, and this is how much you need to borrow. And that's how people hedge options, is they create those synthetic portfolios, but you got to track them constantly. You can't do it one time and forget about it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, folks, we're done for the day, and I will see you on Wednesday. Take care.
Thank you, Professor.
Take care, bye-bye.
Thank you,
good night.
Professor.
Bye.
Thank you.
Take care, bye-bye.